Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the 77th event in this year's Ledbury Poetry Festival, as sponsored with great gratitude by Arts Council England. Tonight, we have great pleasure in presenting two poets publishing their first collections, Caio Cingoni with Chatto and Miriam Nash with Bloodaxe. And Caio's going to read first. He was born in Zambia and moved to Britain at the age of six. His work was included in 10, The New Wave, the second anthology from the Complete Works Mentoring Scheme, a national program supporting exceptional black and Asian poets. And as I say, he's just published his first book-length collection, Kumukanda. Translating as initiation, Kumukanda is the name given to the rites a young boy from the Livale tribe must pass through before he's considered a man. His poetry explores this passage between two worlds, ancestral and contemporary, between the living and the dead, between the gulf of how he is and how he is perceived. Underpinned by a love of music, language and literature, Kumukanda is a powerful exploration of what it means to be British and not British all at once. Orson Shearer has called the book a brilliant debut, a tender, nostalgic and at times darkly hilarious exploration of black boyhood, masculinity, and grief. So would you please welcome Caio Cingoni.
Thank you, Neil, for the introduction, and to Chloe Garner and all those who work on Ledbury Poetry Festival, which is one of my favourites. I wanted to read mostly from the second half of the book because I tend not to read from the second half because I don't know why, really. So I'm going to read more or less straight through the second half, but I'll start with the poem that I usually begin with, which is the very first poem in the book, which is called The Colour of James Brown's Scream. This poem is for Todd Bracey and Steve McCarthy. Steve McCarthy is my friend Karen's brother. I told Karen I was writing a poem about the DJ Larry Levan, and she said, "You've got to speak to my brother because he used to go to Larry Levan's club night in the 70s in New York." And I spoke to Steve, and he said, I'm not a poet exactly, but here are some of my thoughts, and he wrote this long kind of stream of consciousness and some of his words and phrases and descriptions of that time, and some of Todd's are also in this poem. The Colour of James Brown's Scream. I have known you by many names, but today you are Larry Levan, your hand on the platter in the smoky room of a garage regular's memory. You're keeping when doves cry in time as you swing your hips and sweat drips from your hair the colour of James Brown's scream. King of King Street. We're still moving to the same sound, though some of us don't know it is your grave we dance on. Cutting shapes, machismo lost to the beat. Every roadman is a sweet boy if the DJ plays heartbroken at just the right time for these jaded feet. Teach us to shapeshift, Legba. You must know I'd know your customary shuffle, that phantom limp anywhere, that I see your hand in the abandon of a couple, middle of the floor, sliding quick and slick as a skin fade by the hand of a Puerto Rican clipper man who wields a cutthroat like a paintbrush. Let us become like them, an ode to night, ordering beer in a corporeal language from a barman who replies by sweeping his arms in an arc, Willy Ninja style. To fix a drink our lips will yearn for, a taste we've been trying to recreate ever since." I was speaking with Miriam in the very wonderful hospitality area complete with sloping floor, which is disorientating but also jaunty. We're talking about how having a book in your hand that you can hold means that you're more disposed to reading from one when you give readings, even though both of us are inclined to reciting work from memory. So what you're seeing here is rather an exclusive performance of reading at times, although some of these poems I don't know by heart. So this is the second half of the book is where I suppose I was being more direct in certain ways. And so these poems have to do with some of them loss, some of them grief, but also there's some joy and celebration in there as well. But I'll read a selection of them and then maybe move back to earlier in the book as well. But this is a poem called How to Cry. I very rarely explain why I wrote a poem, but this was the very first girlfriend I had was, before we were together, was kind of my best friend in a way. And so that breakup was particularly difficult because it was losing a friend and a partner at the same time. And I wrote into that space a lot afterwards, as one is wont to do. Only a few of those poems were successful, and I think maybe this is one of them. It's called How to Cry. I'm going to fold as an overloaded trestle folds in the middle of Romford Market, and bawl the way my small niece bawls for her mother when she leaves the room. In spite of our assurances, already the little one knows that those who leave might never come back. Though I keep God in a small closed box, I'll prostrate myself outside Argos, beat the cobbles with my palm till blood rings in my fingertips. There amid cockneys selling fish, box fresh from Billingsgate, tears will occur to eyes I thought I'd cried out. I want to be set off by our red brick uni, its array of strange faces. Show me round the flat that stinks of our sleeplessness, plans hatched in the whispers of small hours. I'm tired of this strength. Let me be bereft, watching the white limousine as it drives away. This is the title poem of the collection, which Neil helpfully explained what the word means. Kumukanda is a word from the Luvali language, which is my father's language, and I've just recently begun to meet that part of myself directly through family. I have a very large family, lots of whom I wasn't in contact with for a long time. And the Luvali side of the family is a very celebratory side, to the extent that when I went to see them in Zambia recently, they threw me a party when I got there, and then they threw me a party when I left, to which everyone in the family was invited, including the very little kids who were practicing breakdance moves long into the night. So if you imagine a room full of people much like this, but dancing with small children running up and down, practicing breakdance moves, then you'll have the atmosphere of this poem. Kumukanda. Since I haven't danced among my fellow initiates, following a looped procession from woods at the edge of a village, Tata's people would think me unfinished, a child who never sloughed off the childish estate to cross the river boys of our tribe must cross in order to die and come back grown. I was raised in a strange land by small increments, when I bathed my mother the days she was too weak, when Auntie broke the news and I chose a yellow suit and white shoes to dress my mother's body. At the graveside, when the man I almost grew to call Dad, though we both needed a hug, shook my hand. If my alternate self, who never left, could see me, what would he make of these literary pretensions? This need to speak with a tongue that isn't mine. Would he be strange to me, as I to him, frowning as he greets me in the language of my father, and my father's father, and my father's father's father? I want to read this poem, which is for my niece, who I spent some time with recently after not having seen her for a while. When she hasn't seen us for a while, she gets very excited in our company, but that means that we can't actually interact with her. She runs into sofas, jumps off them, runs around, runs away. It's intense for someone who's as laid back in day-to-day life as I am. But I've had to access an internal hyperactivity. This is called Malumbo. Malumbo is a kind of a celebration, almost like a praise song for somebody, either when they're born or when they die or some formative moment in their life. Malumbo for Malaika. Your parents rejected my suggestion. I told them you could pull off Ethel. The jury is still out. Alicia, out of the question. Ditto Shaniqua and Chantel. I have a soft spot for Dambisa, Malaika, or Mambwe. But whatever you are called, you should know we've all been waiting for your birthday. The look on your face as you apprehend snow. I hope you hold on to your wonder, that you'll never grow so stiffly poised a scent or song is not enough to conjure that smile of yours, the fullness of your voice. I mentioned the phrase skin fade in a poem I read earlier. A skin fade is one of my favorite things in the world. It's a term from the cutting of hair, whereby you move from baldness to hair in a smooth transition. And I was thinking about the ways in which this book having to do with formative moments and coming of age. I was thinking of the ways in which we would mark ourselves out as young men. And a wonderfully executed skin fade was always a mark of great respectability in my circles. And this is a celebration of that. It's called Waves. The year waves came in, when we sang your sweet like chocolate boy without shame. Everyone had a method for taming even the most rebellious head of pepper grains into slick, crazy-paved deference to R&B stars looming large from hoardings, pasted into diaries and exercise books, their lyrics written out on the backs of hands. We wanted to be wanted like that, so we slept with our mother's head wraps tight to keep the facade in place. Some taught themselves the grace of clippers so they could tidy up their edges in the bathroom mirror. Others sought the counsel of barbers, technicians of the razor blade who could elevate a trim to a thing of head-turning, transcendent beauty. But for all we tried to hide our stubble, ashamed of the hair's natural grain, it came back, unbidden, as if each follicle knew that soon we would covet shaved lines in sideburns, eyebrows, anything to set ourselves apart, betray our roots. I often ask if there are any basketball fans in the audience, which in this country is just not, it's not a fruitful question. Occasionally, you'd be surprised, there are weird pockets of basketball fanaticism, but I don't know if Ledbury is one. But anyway, if anybody is a basketball fan, this is specifically for you. For everybody else, I'll try and make it, I mean, it's not that hard to understand. It's based on a game called Horse that in basketball you play in order to become better at shooting, mostly. You usually play with two people or three. And the idea behind the game is whoever starts tries to make a basket that is so skillful that the person following them cannot match that same exact manner of scoring. And this is complicated slightly in this poem by the fact that I'm playing horse with somebody who no longer exists. August. Each of us in shorts, a white tee. This warmth has brought the ballers out in force, and though he's been dead since 1993, my father and I play a game of horse. Next to us, a group of friends play 3-on-3, backed by biggies, elegant contortions, to better demonstrate the importance of style. I stop, push off from my right knee, willing the flick of my wrist to yield the sort of gorgeous arc that's talked about for weeks. The rim gives back the sound of falling short. I pass the ball to the top of the key. Tata throws up a fadeaway and scores. I can't match him and collect the letter E. I should have said, actually, that it's kind of like hangman. Every time you can't match the shot, you get a different letter. Some people play horse, some people play chump, some people play loser. It's good fun. It's good fun. Good for the ego. I just read maybe three more poems to finish here. I mentioned that I would go back a little bit, and so this is me going back. This is a poem called Broomhall. Broomhall is an area of Sheffield where I lived as an undergraduate. In Sheffield, not Broomhall. I lived very near to it. But Broomhall was fun because it was where I would go to have nostalgic moments, mostly around the purchasing of certain kinds of food, which hadn't caught on in other districts of Sheffield, particularly the student districts, which had loads of kind of organic vegetable shops, which were great, but didn't have the stuff I wanted, which some of which had never been involved in any natural process whatsoever. I really love drinks that are purple and blue. Broomhall. In light of what my aunt calls the Arabic texture of my hair, I'm Abdi outside the only shop selling tamarind balls, Irish moss, super malt in decent quantities. It is not enough to say I miss the smell of cassava roasted over open coals, expeditions in want of tilapia, capenta, assorted meats of questionable provenance. How much, auntie? Barter and bluff and rough hands of stall holders glazed to a deep blue, shameless blackness that is consigned now to another life before this one. Of middle-class white boys in reggae bands who love roots and culture as if their love is enough to know the code that some of us live and die by. At least these boys who call me Abdi seem to be fond of Abdi. They ask why I don't come round no more, what it's like in Leeds, and maybe today I can be Abdi and this shop can be all the home I need. I just want to greet Senny, who just walked in. Hello. I mentioned Leeds in that poem. Senny's from Leeds. It's just a magical arrangement that we made. This is a poem in celebration of my cousin and my cousin's friends. I have the distinction of being within my particular family unit the youngest, and that means that I've been influenced in loads of great ways by people older than me. But also, it means that instead of hanging out with my own friends, I would sometimes hang out with their friends, which was very much my experience between the ages of kind of 15 and 17, hanging around with my cousin Katai and all of his friends, who at that time were really interested in garage and grime and DJing and MCing. And so I would be observing and saving it for later, as it turns out. This is a poem called Winter Song. 2002. Raps, Hasty, K-Star, JD, Sickness, Ashley, and me. Standing in the cold outside Smokester's house. Smokester is the only one we know who owns a copy of Snowman, Wiley Cat's latest white label. I remember this as my bus goes past what was once the Mattapan, now dubbed the Beacon Tree, to rid itself of infamy. This being the same spot where Charles Butler was chased round his car by a gunman, shot and collapsed in the road. The songs we wanted to hear lived on tapes of pirate radio sets or in the first-hand crackle of vinyl from Boogie Times or Rhythm Division. When Snowman starts up, I'm back there in the Arctic north of boyhood, lost in the moment just before the bass drops. And I'll finish with a teeny tiny poem right at the end of the book. This is a poem called For Those Orphaned Late in Life. What if the wind blowing through the French doors of your childhood is the house's way of saying goodbye? And when you call out, answering yourself, greeting the gone out of habit, you hear for the first time the timbre of your voice, how someone else might. Thank you.
Thank you, Kai, for that fantastic reading. Now, Miriam Nash won an Eric Gregory Award in 2015 and read at Ledbury in our Gregory Poets reading just 2 years ago. I was so impressed by her work then that I took her to one side and whispered, out of hearing of the other poets, I hoped, that once she had her first collection assembled, would she please send it to me at Blood Axe. Now, that first collection, All the Prayers in the House, was published now 2 years later, end of June, and this is one of her first launch readings from the book. That was also, as she'll probably tell you, the day before she got married. So a remarkably lucky day. Miriam spent her early years on the Isle of Eraid, on the west coast of Scotland, where Robert Louis Stevenson's family once worked as lighthouse engineers. Voices of the island echo through All the Prayers in the House, which holds at its heart the rupture and reimagining of a family. Bold, honest, playful and inventive, the collection travels far from its coastal beginnings, crossing the Atlantic, visiting a women's prison, and a 17th century ladies' dictionary. Here are poems of ritual and transgression, safety and danger. They take the form of songs, letters, fragments, formal verse, many kinds of prayers, perhaps, for many kinds of storm. Last year, Miriam was the first writer in residence at Greenway, Agatha Christie's summer home, and she was runner-up for the Edwin Morgan Poetry Award. One of that award's two judges, Jackie Kay, said, "Miriam Nash's work is thematically satisfying, energetic, and dynamic. These anarchic poems are the product of an original and febrile mind. A blast. Please welcome Miriam Nash. Okay.
Thank you so much, Neil. And thank you for this beautiful book, which has happened because of you. I'm so happy that we can have this launch event. And it's actually the first reading that I have done with Neil. It's one of my first readings of this book. And thank you all for being here for this special moment. Thank you also so much to Ledbury Poetry Festival and to all who make that possible. I'm going to read some of the island and lighthouse poems and some other poems just move through the book a little bit. I'm still getting used to doing that. And as Kayo said, I'm still getting used to holding the book in my hands. It's also such an honour to read with Kayo, who had a really important hand in this book and was one of the people who read it early on and gave me feedback and has really supported it. Thank you. This is called To Tend a Light. To tend a light is a religious thing. Think of the Father words. Heed, keep, candle in the sea. Think of the monotony, the senselessness the northern cold brings in, the dark, the need. You wait for the night when the storm is real and an actual ship comes close enough to wreck. You dread. Are you a warning or a guide? You're inefficient and you curse your work and worse, your love of it. You climb your ladder one last time. You sit. This is called The Lights. It's getting dark again. A closer dark that's harder to shake off. And I think of the light keepers in their granite towers, oiling bolts, winding weights in the 19th century dark, scrubbing dishes, writing the log, testing the bulbs of the 20th century light, the final keeper climbing down his ladder in 1998 at the end of his shift. An automated switch, a microchip, monitored in Edinburgh, where 2 centuries before, one Thomas Smith, manufacturer of street lamps, sat with an oil flame and a Scottish map. I strike a match over dark reefs where ships would crack. The year unhooks its tall black hat for the old act of vanishing. So this next poem takes its title from a job ad for lighthouse keepers from the Northern Lighthouse Board. And the job ad says, a lightkeeper must be a man of parts. From his study of the sea, he will respect its immense power. He will be a handyman of varying proficiency, a useful cook and a good companion, which I think is just a great job ad. This poem is really a kind of love poem to my dad, who was not a lighthouse keeper. But when I was very young, he and my mum moved to the Isle of Erraid, a tiny island really in the middle of the elements, which was a very brave thing to do, I think. A lightkeeper must be a man of parts. My father was a handyman of varying proficiency. A city boy turned tractor driver, salmon fisher, fish gutter. Public school had landed him unqualified for chainsaw use, but he was driven. Wood splitter, throat slitter, vegetarian chicken killer, soup cook, potato digger, cow milker, sheep dipper. Look, we're married with a child. Think about the reasons later. Shapeshifter, meditator, bookkeeper, drug taker. Hearth father, water father, takes me on his work day. Father holds the light for me. My father, terrified of dark. So Robert Louis Stevenson was sent to the Isle of Erraid in his early 20s, and his family hoped that he would follow in the family tradition and become a lighthouse engineer. But by all accounts, he spent most of his time wandering around the island and thinking up stories. And he later used the Isle of Erraid in Kidnapped, and he did some other writings about it. So this is the letter to him. It's called Letter to RLS. Dear Mr. Stevenson, dear Robert, I believe you would approve of this, my writing to the dead, as you yourself said that the spirit of true correspondence is the willingness to pour forth unmitigated rot. What with you witching on some far else island and us never having met, it's difficult to really speak to you. But once upon two very different times, we both inhabited a tiny Scottish islet by the name of Erraid. I'm greedy for your memories of it. I think you'd have enjoyed the mad extended families who washed up with me on that rock. Angels of potatoes, inner guidance and electric light. Perhaps you took on a form, dear RLS, and visited. Once I was digging in the garden with my little trowel and found a letter seal with a lion stamp. I called it the Princess because its handle looped and coiled like a head and dress. Here she is next to me. I write from Lewisham. I like to think you might have lost her in the summer when they say your father failed to turn you lighthouse engineer. Dear Robert, fellow incomer and maker up of islands where I say I come from, as if I could emerge like a seal's head from the sea, make one more fiction and write back to me. Yours with affection, Miriam. This is Robert Louis Stevenson's reply to me. I have some water for it. So this is a collage poem, which is made up of different parts of different letters that Robert Louis Stevenson wrote to different people at different times in his life. So all the words are his. I've just added the words, Dear Miriam. He sadly did not write to any Miriams, which is a great shame. If anyone finds an unknown letter to a Miriam, that would be great. And in this poem, Robert Louis Stevenson, or perhaps the ghost of Robert Louis Stevenson, talks at one point about his life in the South Seas, by which he means Samoa. He ended his life, he spent the last years of his life with his family in Samoa, on an island there, and he became very embedded in the island where he was living and took on the name Tusitala, which means storyteller. He really had quite an interesting life. This is Letter from RLS. Dear Miriam, I hope you will be able to decipher this, written at steam speed with a breaking pen, the hot fast postman at my heels. This is the first letter I have written this good while. Your wild and ravening commands were received. Erraid, where I lived lang syne, the island, the roost, the merry men, silver and clocks and brocades, and what a conscience, what a mad brain. as you say, false imagination, but I love the name, nature, and being of them. The cold was beyond belief. I have often suffered less at a dentist's. I can well remember when the Franco-Prussian War began, I was at Aileen-Erade, far enough from the sound of the loudest cannonade. I could hear the shots fired, and I felt the pang in my breast of a man struck. It was sometimes so distressing, so instant, that I lay in the heather on the top of the island. I am glad you have gone back to your music. Life is a poor thing, I am more and more convinced, without an art that always waits for us and is always new. Come, let us take counsel together and make some. It would surprise you if you came out tonight from Honolulu, all shining with electric lights and all in a bustle from the arrival of the mail which is to carry you these lines, and crossed the long wooden causeway along the beach, and came out on the road through the park, and seeing a gate in the palings with a tub of goldfish by the wayside, entered casually in. There you will find the lamps burning, and the family sitting about the table, dinner just done. My mother, my wife, Lloyd, Belle, my wife's daughter, Austin, her child, and tonight, by way of rarity, a guest. All about the walls, our South Sea curiosities, war clubs, idols, pearl shells, stone axes. What do you think this is? Simply life in the South Seas foreshortened. All is at a standstill. Books closed, paper put aside, the voice, the eternal voice of RLS well silenced. I shall be dead indeed. This is a devilish egotistical yarn. Will you try to imitate me in that, if the spirit ever moves you to reply? Adieu, write, yours ever, RLS. So this is a poem which is a pantoum, which is a Malay form. But here, in writing this, I felt that the pantoum is a folk form in some ways akin to some Celtic folk forms. And this poem is called The Walking Father Blues. How does a father leave his life? Easy, a pair of walking shoes. And who can hear them but his wife, walking the walking father blues? Easy, the pair of walking shoes lead him at last to his new door, walking the walking father blues, for the new wife says she'll wait no more. Lead him at last to his new door. The doorknob does not strike him down, and the new wife says she'll wait no more, wrapped in the old one's dressing gown. The doorknob does not strike him down. The clock must race to meet their time. Wrapped in the old one's dressing gown, the new wife says they've done no crime. The clock must race to meet their time. The mugs swing neatly from their hooks. The new wife says they've done no crime and dances while the father cooks. The mugs swing neatly from their hooks. She locks the windows, bars the gate. She dances while the father cooks, for her body holds a lovely weight. She locks the windows, bars the gate. She hides his battered walking shoes and holds her body's lovely weight, for she will not sing her child the blues. She hides the battered walking shoes, for who must fear them but a wife who will not sing her child the blues of how a father leaves his life. So we will remain in some place of difficulty and darkness, and then we will move up and out. This is a poem called The Task. The night when you lie most apart, when one of you is underwater and the other underground, the silence in the bed between you will rise in the shape of a stranger. The hair that each of you has lost will be her hair. The look you long for in the other's eyes will light her face. Her body will be made of wishes that you cast together long ago. One of you will wake and see her backlit by the door, and it will take a force that isn't in that moment love, not to follow her downstairs, but turn to search the darkness for your lover who might be shadow now or gone. In writing this book, I got to think quite a lot about stories I was told as a child. And some of those were Scottish folk stories. And there are some Selkies who come in and out of this book in different ways. But this story is based on an Irish folk tale that I was told as a child. You don't need to know the story. It's told in the poem in some way. And it's called The Story of the Bones. It's in two parts. One. The place I'm always looking in this story is the time the lover children spend in death. She, in the actual death she orders, kill me, take my bones. He, laying a ladder of her bones down one side of the well. Backwards down her skeleton he goes, and if he doesn't find the ring, doesn't find the force to turn and climb, if he doesn't pull her bones out after him and fix each bone exactly in its place, she'll never breathe again. The story says his heartbeat pauses as he brings her bones together on the grass, basket of her jaw, staff of her spine. No breath comes from him until he sets the ring over her chest. She lives. All he gets wrong is one little finger, bent, and when he has to choose a wife among three hands by reaching through a curtain, he knows her by the crook of his mistake. This is the beginning of their marriage. Two. Now I'm outside of where I was, it's difficult to tell you where I was. The bathroom sink became a well I looked down every morning. I thought about it before sleeping, and I thought about the story of the bones. Down there, the analogy made sense. I was the boy. The task, to take my dead bones down the well and bring my living back. I was the girl too, watching myself climb and fail. When I noticed you there, I asked myself if you might be the boy, the girl, the bones. You couldn't be, I thought. The climb is solitary. The story hurt you. You wanted to sledgehammer the well and pull me free. But you kept close. You held whatever bones you could. Here is the grass and finally the sky. hold up my finger to the light, and there, the ring I found so difficult to wear before. This is the beginning of our marriage. So, Neil mentioned the Ladies' Dictionary, and I haven't yet read any poems from the Ladies' Dictionary in any reading, so perhaps we'll have one. The Ladies' Dictionary, 1694, is a book written by a bunch of men, of course, in 1694, who compiled it from a lot of different sources. There was no copyright at the time in the way that there is now. It is a really interesting book. I'll just read the little note from the back. It's called A General Entertainment for the Fair Sex, which is already quite dangerous. It's known as the first encyclopedic book published in English with women as its primary target audience, and was probably the first alphabetically organised encyclopedic book published in English. And actually, the alphabetization of the book is really dodgy. They've got the letters in the right order, but then, you know, it sort of doesn't quite go from there. But I found this book because I was on the internet researching the history of shoplifting, as one does. And I found this great little entry from a book called The Ladies' Dictionary. And so I went to look for that book, and I ended up writing a number of poems from entries in that book. And the book is fascinating. It has women's names. It has medical information. It has lots about dress and clothing, but also lots about behaviour and mythology. And it's a really interesting book. And this is this poem, which is called Shoplift, has a little bit of the Shoplift entry above it. It says, "She is most commonly well clad, and one that wants more of grace than wit. She has several large pockets about her. Not for jewelled wrists, or to show friends, or shut the throats of girls who ask, what is the baddest thing I've ever done? Not to reward A stars in tests, or punish mum for being mum. Just for an itch of gem under my sleeve, a weight tucked in. I move through barriers as if an angel shadowed me, disarming senses with a swish of wing. Invisible, I walk my own small values down the street." What I wanted was to let some of the ladies from the Ladies' Dictionary speak for themselves. And sometimes they speak in my imagined, sometimes they speak in voices that come from an earlier time, my imagining of the 17th century. And sometimes they speak in a more modern voice. But this next poem that I'm going to read is The Visitation of a Women's Prison. It was written in the time I spent 2 years while writing this book in New York. And while I was there, I ran a creative writing workshop every week with other students from my university in a women's prison. And the prison was in a town in New York State called Valhalla, which, as you may know, is a hall of the gods in Norse mythology. And the women in the jail referred to the jail itself as Valhalla. And so this is a poem called Ladies of Valhalla, Care of the County Jail, Valhalla, New York. Dear ladies of Valhalla, since I got home to England, I miss being the English girl who wrote with you on Mondays in the library of few books. Whenever I remember it, of course, I hear the geese moan like sick instruments and see our heads at work around the table, cooking up some other room, some scent. My favourite was the time we said we'd climb the alphabet and picked a letter each. I'm writing from the top deck of a bee. Dear ladies of Valhalla, since I got home, I filled a cabinet with rows of nail polish. It makes me think of walking in and out the gates each week with something sparkling at my fingertips and how you'd always notice it and ask the colour's name. Today I'm feeling pale and duck egg blue. My weather's the thin rain that creeps up sleeves. I wish you manicures. May you inspect your fingers with delight. I wish you houses you can always leave. Dear ladies of Valhalla, since I got home, I've read about Valhalla of the myths. The ladies of Valhalla circle the darkest battlefields and streets and sweep the bravest dead onto their backs. Valhalla is the great hall where they'll feast under a canopy of shields and wait to meet the final battle of the world. Dear ladies of Valhalla, New York State, may you be fed and rested for the fight. I wish you armor and a place to eat. Dear ladies of Valhalla, since I got home to England, I miss being the English girl who says her words so that you'd want to eat them as they walk out of her mouth. I hope you're out of there and don't receive this, but in case you do, I send you cherry chutney, bouncer, it's me, Bastille, my heart, my point exactly, and my beloved duck egg blue. I wish that by some charm they pass security. It's Monday evening and I think of you. I'm going to end with the poem that I performed here 2 years ago, almost exactly. It's a poem that I also read at my own wedding, which was the next day. After that reading, this poem is for Christo, it comes with my great thanks that you were willing to run around on that day 2 years ago, doing all kinds of things and organizing everything, overseeing all that my family were doing, while I was here having some cider and giving a reading. This is Love Song for a Keeper. If nothing of us lasts past 7 years, each speck of skin replaced, old cells reborn, then soon the crisscross lines inside your palm, where I pretended to read kids, careers, won't recognize my thumbprint anymore. This fleck of face, that furthest tip of tongue, whole parts of us will never know they touched. Nights when our tiny room swelled up with breath, till one window exhaled for us at dawn. Lost it. Of course. I'll start again. Thank you. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you to the festival and to Kayo and to Neil. This is Love Song for a Keeper. If nothing of us lasts past 7 years, each speck of skin replaced, old cells reborn, then soon the crisscross lines inside your palm where I pretended to read kids, careers, won't recognize my thumbprints anymore. This fleck of face, that furthest tip of tongue, whole parts of us will never know they touched. Nights when our tiny room swelled up with breath, till one window exhaled for us at dawn. Then will our new skin falter in the sudden cold unknown? Will bones be what we dig for? When our chests press again, stranger to stranger, our particles in motion, trembling, raw, let my flesh blaze to yours for 7 more. Thank you very much.